From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Marlboro's Man, Bob Dole and Big Tobacco's Comeback Strategy, a Mother Jones Magazine expose.
If Dole is president, they will defund all federal scientists looking at, for example, the carcinogenic effects of secondhand smoke, and they will gut OSHA, they already have, they will gut the EPA, and they will say, Dole will say, I don't know whether nicotine's addictive or not, but I think this matter best handled by the states.
The continuing controversy over minority congressional districts in Georgia and the South.
The racism in the state of Georgia, particularly relative to politics and reapportionment, is the worst, most putrid, stupidest, backward human human endeavors or activities.
We look at state and national legislation against genetic discrimination following this week's court-martial of two Marines for refusing to give their DNA to the military. All this and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. I'm here also with Larry Bensky, Pacifica's National Affairs Correspondent. Welcome, Larry.
Thanks, Amy.
Some interesting headlines today. Pat Buchanan all but ruled out a third-party run for the presidency yesterday, calling his chances as an independent candidate increasingly unrealistic as November's election nears. Buchanan also told reporters that he will nominally remain in the Republican race despite a decision to cancel 2 weeks of planned campaigning in Pennsylvania, the next state to hold the primary. And his appearance at the press conference really, though, was meant to announce his push to deny trade preferences to China, part one of a new drive to be a Republican player on key election year issues. Buchanan also planned to push Republicans on adopting America First trade and defense policies, rolling back legal immigration, ending affirmative action, and banning abortion. So he is going to remain a player. And a piece in the Washington Post today on a judge's decision in Florida. A panel of three federal judges has ruled unconstitutional a congressional district that weaves through Florida from Jacksonville to Orlando to create a district favorable to the election of an African American. The ruling is the latest of several that have gone against majority black congressional districts. It requires the Florida legislature to redraw the lines by May 22nd in preparation for the 96 election. The ruling also threatens the political future of incumbent Democratic Congressmember Corinne Brown. She's immediately announced her plans to appeal.
And we're going to be looking later in the show at another district where that is very much on the agenda, Cynthia McKinney's district in Georgia.
That's right. We'll be doing that in the second part of the show. In the Senate, a major decision yesterday, the Senate approved an anti-terrorism bill that would dramatically curb the power of federal courts to determine whether state death row inmates have been wrongly imprisoned. We're going to deal with that tomorrow on the first anniversary of the Oklahoma City bombing. And two interesting pieces in the New York Times today. The wall of Republican opposition to raising the minimum wage cracked yesterday when Speaker Newt Gingrich told House Republicans that they should prepare themselves to face a vote on the issue, a vote that would almost surely lead to an increase. And both the House and Senate lawmakers of both parties agree that an increase will pass if there is a vote on the proposal. And in an interesting analysis piece that was in the Times today, Senator Bob Dole's strategy, they're predicting, campaign from the Senate floor by getting legislation passed to contrast himself with President Clinton. And it says that Dole's setback over the minimum wage legislation suggests the pitfalls of that strategy. We're going to be talking about Bob Dole right now. We're turning to the May issue of Mother Jones. It's a special issue called Inside the Nicotine Network, Bob Dole and Big Tobacco's Comeback Strategy. We're joined by the editor of Mother Jones. He is Jeffrey Klein. Tell us, Jeffrey, about your findings.
Many things. It's a multi-tiered strategy. Tobacco has obviously had a bad couple of months, but they've had bad months before in their 100-year history of disinformation, fraud, and basically deceiving the American public. And they have a new strategy to come back. It consists of this. Number one, they want to win the presidency. If Dole is president, they will defund all federal scientists looking at, for example, the carcinogenic effects of secondhand smoke. And they will gut OSHA, they already have, they will gut the EPA, and they will say, Dole will say, I don't know whether nicotine's addictive or not, but I think this matter best handled by the states.
How much money does tobacco pour into this, basically, war against humanity, and how do they do it?
Well, hundreds of millions of dollars, and it's extremely difficult to track. For example, in the soft money, you're over for some million, but as our articles show, they're giving to the governors, they're giving to the state legislatures, and we've uncovered phony grassroots groups in virtually every state we looked at. In some of them, there are $5 million enterprises, and others, there's $30 million enterprises.
Citizens Against Government Interference, names like that.
That's the Wichita Falls one. I like the one in Colorado particularly, which is Citizens Against Government Abuse and Tax Waste. And you look closer, and we found a $2.5 million check that went in to a bank that's laundered and then comes out to this committee. And overall, I believe they give $5 million. These look like grassroots organizations. And sometimes when we went to the filing forms, you'd see this sad thing where you'd get $750,000 from the Tobacco Institute, $375,000 from RJR, you know, $600,000 from Philip Morris, and $10 from Lola, you know, Hopkins. So Lola Hopkins probably wants to get government off her backs, but she's being turbocharged by $2 million of Tobacco Institute money.
Well, let's talk about the top man, Bob Dole, Senate
yes.
Majority Leader, and maybe
yes.
the next president, his yes. connection to tobacco.
He has a longstanding connection to tobacco. I would say he's the most important tobacco player in the city precisely because he's not identified the way Bliley and Senator Helms are with it. He has a long history with them. There's two particular incidents which we detail in the magazine that are troubling. Number one, he is the legislator most responsible for the epidemic of smokeless tobacco, which is a euphemism for spit tobacco or chew tobacco. In 85, an excise tax was proposed that would raise the level of taxation on it to that of cigarettes. He defeated it. He slipped in a tobacco subsidy that Jesse Helms crafted. It continues to be an epidemic. I talked to Surgeon General, the former Surgeon General Novello. She said the main reason kids chew is because when they chew, it's cheaper, and kids are price sensitive. Chew tobacco, by the way, is far more addictive than cigarettes, and they move on to cigarettes anyway. Number two, and probably more important, is he was behind ramming open the doors in Asia for American cigarettes. And not only were American cigarettes put in there, we forced on those countries American marketing techniques. Previously, they had public health prohibitions, for example, on TV advertising. We have documents showing that he was personally responsible for opening up these markets. And as a result, let's take Korea, for example. Because of a deal that he negotiated, a year afterwards, Korean teenage boys rose from 18 to 30% who were smokers, and teenage girls from 2 to 9%. Very common. Asian girls didn't smoke before U.S. Marketing techniques went in there.
Well, you know, with all this information about Bob Dole, and I assume the Pacifica listeners, being the readers that they are, will want to get this issue of Mother Jones and read it for themselves so we don't have to dwell on all the details
right.
and put it into their heads. I'm more interested in the effects that this expose is going to have, your cover story, Bob Dole and Big Tobacco's comeback strategy, and a great cartoon of him as Marlboro's man. What's happening here in Washington, Jeffrey, as you go around and being the media savvy person that you are, try to put this story in places that will not only get the word out, but call attention to Mother Jones? It's about Bob Dole. What are people saying to you? Are you able to get the kind of resonance you thought you'd get for it?
No. And my initial assessment of it is troubling. I probably need another week to see what filters through, but the initial reaction.
No pun intended about that filter.
Yeah. The initial reaction.
Better than not filtering.
Is that the reporters and the producers are quite excited about it. They said, okay, Dole, we need Dole news. And then something happens and they come back to me and they say, well, the Dole part of it is good, but it's sort of hard to tell on TV. What we're more interested in is in the fraud in Texas or in the fraud in Minnesota. Mind you, I'm glad to get any coverage, but they don't go to lunch with the people in Minnesota and the people in Texas. They go to lunch with the Dole people, and they're very hesitant to do it. I never said they should, go out and savage Dole. All they said, I said to them, and these are big networks, is make Dole go on the record. Does he think, for example, nicotine is addictive? If he were elected, would he fire David Kessler? Does he have any regrets about jamming open these Asian markets? Is he sorry that he didn't raise the taxes on chew tobacco to the level of cigarettes? Fundamental questions, the number one public health issue of our time, and you can't get the Republican nominee on the record. Then I said, with all we've disclosed tons of his top advisors who are currently working for the tobacco companies. Go to Dole and ask him, did he know? Does he have any problems with this? We've disclosed that Philip Morris is sponsoring the two key events at the Republican National Convention. Ask him, is he sorry about this? I cannot at this point get the big networks to do that.
Considering you're not getting the coverage, let's talk about these senior advisors to the Dole campaign who have close ties to the tobacco industry.
Well, we start off with Roderick Armont, and he's chairman of Lawyers for Dole. Last count was about 700 Lawyers for Dole. He's a former chief of staff. He'd have a big job in a Dole administration. What's troubling is he's from this firm of Covington & Burling, big, prestigious Washington firm. We discovered that Covington & Burling is sending around the country to attorneys general in various states a team to intimidate them. In Texas, we found that they threatened the attorney general there that if he joined this suit, they would smear him. They surveyed for him a push poll, which is a smear campaign. They were going to run against him.
This is Dan Morales.
Dan Morales. In Massachusetts and lots of other states, they threatened to clog up the courts forever. In a state considering filing, they said, nobody's kidding themselves that nicotine's not addictive, but we'll depose every Medicaid recipient in your state. This is from Roderick DeArmont's firm. He knows about this, I would assume. We can't get him on the record to say that. Is this the kind of lawyers that Dole wants working for him?
In fact, isn't the Covington and Burling partner who's going around a former attorney general?
They have with them Andy Miller, who's another attorney general from Virginia. And in each state they go to, they hire the biggest law firms. This is not on the legal or moral merits. This is simply, we can outmuscle you and make your life miserable. Next one, Steve Merksamer is very crucial. He's a key California strategist, and you get through him.
For Dole.
Yes, and general national advisor. You get from him a sense of what the real tobacco strategy is, which is far from wanting decentralized power, they want to send the issue down to the states and then have governors override it. They want governors to basically subvert what the people want. And
well, sure,
California,
it's easier to buy one governor than it is 435 congressmen.
Absolutely, and the press aren't watching. So Merksamer, who was a very bad guy in California, and his firm brokered the deal with the California Medical Association, which is now keeping the very tough anti-smoking commercials off the air. Merksamer is a key Dole advisor. We have Manafort, the guy who's running Dole's convention, is a big tobacco guy. He worked for Burson Marsteller. We have this
and
Tom,
represents Philip Morris.
Philip Morris. We have this Tom Collymore, who is a vice president for corporate affairs for Philip Morris. He's fundraising for Dole. What I said to the media today, and I'm despairing that they're going to follow on it, is I just found one vice president for corporate affairs at one firm. What's the RJR one doing? What's the Brown and Williamson one doing? I think Dole is surrounded at the highest levels by tobacco people, and it's certainly no accident.
One of the things you have in this Mother Jones issue, many, many pages about this scandal of tobacco, is the transcript of the ABC documentary, Tobacco Under Fire,
right.
The one that was not shown by ABC. And somehow you got a copy of it, and you printed a transcript of it here, and I gather you've sent copies of the tape around and put it on the World Wide Web. Is that correct?
We put the... Paul Friedman, yesterday when he was confronted with this, said, oh, see, Mother Jones just ran...
Who's Paul Friedman?
He's the executive vice president of ABC. He said, oh, Mother Jones only ran excerpts from this show. If they had run the whole thing, people would see how boring it is. So in response to the Friedman test, I have now put the entire transcript up on our worldwide web. If your listeners go to MotherJones.com, they'll see this and they'll see clips from the show. We've also put up on the satellite the whole show, and we sent it out to TV critics to review.
Well, we can do better than that. We can play a little of it for them right here.
One
of the criticisms that ABC used is that the show was too boring to air. What do you think we should listen to next to show how it's not actually very boring?
Fine, I'll tell you, but let me precede that by saying they own the show, they digitized it, they lawyered it, they cut it down to the excerpts that even they admit are newsworthy, and they've been sitting on admitted newsworthy segments for 2 years. My favorite is with Coop. Surgeon General Coop, a very admirable man, says on the tape that he was astounded to discover correspondence between R.J. Reynolds's CEO, I believe, and Ronald Reagan before the inauguration, in which Reagan admitted that he had more important things to do in it during his administration than pursue any tobacco regulation. And
okay,
Coop
well,
talks about how terrible that is.
Let's listen to that now.
There's a lot of money involved here. And you have to remember that the domestic future of the United States cigarette manufacturers is dismal.
Dr. C. Everett Coop was Ronald Reagan's Surgeon General and the most committed anti-smoking activist to ever hold the job.
This is a losing industry in this country. Eventually, we will have a smoke-free society here. And if that's the case, you've got to find some place to get rid of this tobacco. And so why not pick people that can't fight back?
Asia, home to nearly half the world's inhabitants. Its culture and traditions have survived unchanged for centuries. But beginning in 1986, a new wave of American culture washed over Asia.
Come to where the flavor is. Marlboro.
And the tobacco companies could not have done it without the direct help of President Ronald Reagan.
Before he was inaugurated, there was correspondence between the chief executive officer, R.J. Reynolds, and the president, calling attention to the fact that the tobacco company would hope that this president would not be too tough on the tobacco industry. And the president wrote back, I don't know who wrote the letter for him, but I could hardly believe it when I eventually read it, my administration will be too busy with more important things.
Not only did the president do nothing to hurt the major tobacco companies, Ronald Reagan, a former pitchman for Chesterfield cigarettes, actively helped them realize their long-range plans. 8 years ago, Reagan ordered the United States Trade Representative to, in effect, declare economic war on government-run tobacco monopolies in Asia. His main weapon, a presidential order threatening huge tariffs on the exports of any nations the president believed discriminated against American tobacco. Beginning with Japan, our government fought for the tobacco industry's right not only to sell cigarettes, but to advertise them.
So ABC viewers didn't get a chance to see this.
Right. And there are other wonderful segments as well. There's hidden cameras where in the Marlboro van guy talks about how they're trying to hook young kids. There's a hidden camera in a smokers' rights group where the person who's leading it says, you can never say that I organized this.
Believe me, there's been extensive research on how to put these, how to get to you guys.
These meetings are designed to encourage individual smokers to speak out for tobacco interests. They preach about the civil rights of smokers. But the sign outside the room confirms whose interests are really at stake.
Politicians will not listen to you if they think all you are is a mouthpiece for the tobacco companies. Your only prayer is being independent, appearing independent, and for that reason, we don't get directly involved with organizing, you guys.
There's a really poignant segment in which a tobacco farmer says that, you know, they need Kentucky farmers because we grow the best burley, and then the producer confronts him with his seed, his KY seed, that's been grown in Brazil at half the price, because tobacco farmers are the ultimate front group for tobacco. Ultimately, by the way, I believe in 20 years, tobacco will go off over, not just grow overseas and sell overseas, which is where their market is, but they will have their headquarters out of U.S. regulation.
You know, one of the most amazing things about the suppression of the ABC documentary and the flap about the 60 Minutes segment,
yeah,
which was suppressed for a while, is that tobacco doesn't advertise on television. It hasn't been able to since the 1960s. And people who make a kind of a mechanistic assumption, oh, well, right. the television networks are scared of their advertisers, and therefore right. they'll suppress information. These people aren't advertisers.
Well, there's three reasons they're scared. First of all, they do advertise in Kraft and Miller. They have food products. And during the Philip Morris...
Because they're conglomerates.
Yes, and during...
So it's not the tobacco products that are advertised
right.
on television.
And they have made threats that they would pull their Miller products or their Kraft products. Number two, they fear lawsuits. And in both of those instances, mergers were pending, and they wanted the mergers to go through cleanly. And number three, the sort of least remarked upon aspect, is the head of telecommunications regulation is Thomas Bliley, who's better known as the congressman for Philip Morris. And they don't want to make him angry because he can make their lives miserable.
We're talking to Jeffrey Klein. He's editor of Mother Jones. The May issue is a special issue inside the Nicotine Network. We'll be back in just a minute. You're listening to Democracy Now!, Pacifica Radio's daily grassroots election show, and we continue our conversation with Jeffrey Klein, the editor of Mother Jones magazine, the May issue Inside the Nicotine Network, Bob Dole and Big Tobacco's Comeback Strategy. And in a little while, we'll let you know how you can get a copy of this issue. But let me ask you about the governors. This
yes.
operates at all different levels,
yes.
from the presidential candidates to the attorneys general to the governors and the state legislatures.
Yes.
What's happening with them?
Well, with the governors, we discovered something rather comic. I alluded to. We found the governors meeting in Nashua, New Hampshire, where they were shaken down to by tobacco lobbyists to write letters to the FDA protesting the impending regulation of nicotine as a drug. And in exchange, they were going to get cash. And if they didn't do this, they were going to be penalized. A North Dakota official told us exactly how this worked. So then we went into the FDA and pulled out the governor's letters. There's 700,000 letters that the tobacco companies have generated into the FDA, but we found six governor's letters, and they're written in identical language. It's really quite comic. If you go to our issue, you have things like that where they say, one of my favorites is from Mississippi. He says, "This insinuates that I and other members of Mississippi government cannot look out for the well-being of our children and that we therefore must rely on the paternal hand of our federal government. I resent the suggestion that Mississippi is unable to take care of its children." Okay, how about from Montana? "This statement implies that we here in Montana cannot look out for the well-being of our own children and therefore we must rely on the assistance from the omnipresent federal government. Quite frankly, I resent this implication, and I firmly reject this unwarranted federal intrusion into our business." These are clearly tobacco industry drafted letters, in some cases just identical language. You get paid, you write the letter. That's the deal.
Jeffrey, let's talk about this election, because this is a show, at least in part, about electoral
yes.
politics.
Yes.
What can we expect to see this fall in the 1996 election, both on the presidential level and on the congressional and local level, as far as the presence of big tobacco money? And what do they think they're buying?
They know what they're buying. And you're going to see them have 2 and 3 to 1 advantages in lots of races. This is very wealthy companies, $45 billion a year industry, and they know that politics, this is the single biggest political interest in the country. It's the most corrupt, and they're going to, again, turbocharge all these races, including the presidency, including the governor's races, including the representatives. They're going to make it so that their candidates have a very large advantage. You will not see the word tobacco mentioned if they can help it. Anytime they mention tobacco, they lose. So this will just look like the anti-tax movements are very robust, unless some enterprising reporters go into the filing forms, which are often filed too late, and say, God, this wasn't Citizens. This was RJR. This is Philip Morris.
You talked about you talked about Robert Dole. Mm-hmm. What about Clinton and tobacco money?
Clinton is far less dependent on it. I do not give enormous credit to Clinton on this. I give him some credit. But the real driving force behind this is a Bush appointee, Kessler. And Clinton has decided to back David Kessler at the FDA. And because he's backing Kessler, the tobacco industry has decided to go against Clinton. So Clinton is not going to get a lot of tobacco money. There are Democrats who do get tobacco money, and the worst would be Dick Gephardt. And it's because of Dick Gephardt that you're not getting hearings on the obvious perjury that took place before.
Frank Rich did a column in the New York Times called Smoking Out Stargate.
Yes, right.
And he talked about your issue and Mother Jones on the Nicotine Network.
Right.
And he also talked about the fact that President Clinton should make maybe his number one campaign issue is anti-tobacco, is going against tobacco being sold to kids, etc. Do you think he would do that?
I think he should. I think it would be smart because I think it would force Dole to look at the issue. I can't force reporters to, but if a president makes a statement on it, then it becomes an issue in play. Clinton tends to be a rebound player. He doesn't really like to introduce things aggressively. But if it comes up, I think he after the State of the Union address he talked about, I pick on Clinton an awful lot. This is one issue I think he's sincere on.
The only way Clinton will bring this up, realistically speaking, is if the polling and focus groups, which are probably going on even as we speak right now, show that it has resonance among his swing voters. If he sees that the so-called angry white men or Macomb County Democrats or whatever they're called this year perk up their ears and say, yeah, we really got to do something about the dangers of health and smoking, he'll do something.
And yet, Larry, if he does do something about it, he's exposing big money in political campaigns, and then he's going to have to deal with the spotlight on his money.
I would love for him to A, do it, and B, have to deal with that issue. But the truth is, it is very popular. One of the things we exposed in our prior issue was that although ABC caved to Philip Morris, they ran mock jury trials in tobacco country and won. Even people who are smokers want the tobacco industry curbed. They are sick of, and by the way, the best way to stop kids from smoking is to show the cynicism of the executives. If you show kids, that's another thing we're running on this tape, is we're running a suppressed commercial that Pete Wilson took off the air. It does the nicotine soundbites testimony of the chief executives. You run that kind of stuff, then kids say, I don't want to rebel if adults are preying upon me. But what the industry wants, you're seeing this in newspaper ads all across the country, little finger-wagging things that say, don't smoke. Those actually encourage kids to smoke.
Uh-huh. What do you mean Pete Wilson took it off the air?
Yeah, there's a wonderful ad, as I mentioned, Nicotine Soundbites. It's a condensed version of No, I Don't Believe Nicotine is Addictive with the chairman of all the companies, and you can't see it. It was a public service announcement, and it was yanked.
Please consider yourself to be under oath.
Yes or no? Do you believe nicotine is not addictive?
I believe nicotine is not addictive. Cigarettes and nicotine clearly do not meet the classic definitions of addiction. There is no intoxication.
We'll take that as a no.
I believe nicotine is not addictive, and I too believe that nicotine is not addictive.
Now the tobacco industry is trying to tell us that secondhand smoke isn't dangerous.
Not addictive.
Not addictive. Not addictive.
The final frame reads, do they think we're stupid?
One poor little old Sacramento station had a stray cartridge and put it in by mistake, and they ran it. And
they didn't lose their license.
Well, it was yanked down. They yanked it out. They made a call down to the producing firm and make sure that it's not even in existence. I'm also running that on various sites and putting it up on the satellite.
Jeffrey Klein, you talk about the Christian right ignoring spontaneous abortions caused by tobacco.
Right. Well, spontaneous abortions is the medical word, really, for miscarriages, in effect. And there's a good, solid study that estimates that about 100,000 kids miscarriage if the mothers smoke. What could be a more prime issue for the Christian right? Because they're supposedly interested in the lives of the unborn. Here's an instance where mothers want the kids and they're losing them. We have found members of the Christian Coalition, leaders of the Christian right, trying to make Ralph Reed address this as an issue. He has systematically denied talking about it because I don't think finally he's interested in the unborn. He's interested in power. So he's repudiated his own ranks.
But you make it clear in the article, especially when you write about how this network does its work, that it's done almost entirely in secret.
Yes.
Using front group names, using firms that nobody's ever heard of, channeling money all over the place. This is the kind of thing that leads people to say, well, the whole system is so deeply corrupt and so completely out of control that there's no chance of us ever having an impact on us as citizens.
You and I have a longstanding philosophical disagreement on this. If you had journalists who were courageous who exposed this, it would have an immediate effect. Any politician who's exposed...
Big if, Jeffrey.
Big if. But if this stuff comes out in the sunlight, these politicians, these initiatives are systematically defeated. The problem is journalists are scared and lazy.
You think the cigarette papers are going to do it, the 4,000 pages that have been put up on the Internet by University of California, that they're going to put out in a book form like the Pentagon Papers?
I've read those. More power to Stan Glantz. He's one of the best whistleblowers in the country. And if more of those come forward, these whistleblowers are helping. They're changing the climate.
You think it's going to happen before the 96 election?
I hope.
Jeffrey Klein, we want to thank you very much for joining us. Again, why don't you give us your phone number at Mother Jones if people want to get a copy of this edition of Mother Jones and any other?
1-800-GET-MOJO.
That's what?
1-800-GET-MOJO.
That's GETMOJO.
Yes.
We
want to
thank you for joining us, Mother
Thanks
Jones, editor Jeffrey Klein.
Thanks, Jeffrey.
And if you'd like to get a copy of this program, Democracy Now!, you can call the Pacifica Archives at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230 and purchase a copy of the program. I'm Amy Goodman here with Larry Bensky. And now, Larry, you've been following the latest on the continuing controversy over congressional districts in the South with African-American representatives.
Indeed I have, Amy. Thank you. Yesterday, in fact, a federal appeals court in Florida ruled that a new Central Florida congressional district represents unconstitutional districting. This is the latest in a series of rulings which threaten a number of recently elected black members of the House of Representatives. In this particular case, the court has ruled that Congresswoman Corinne Brown's 3rd District in Florida, which takes in parts of Jacksonville, Gainesville, Daytona Beach, and Orlando, is in violation of a Supreme Court decision which somewhat limits, in a nonspecific and very confusing way, so-called race-based districts. The Florida legislature is now going to have a month to draw new lines in time for this year's election, but those lines may well be appealed by Congresswoman Brown and civil rights organizations which are concerned about the possible loss of representation for African Americans in Congress. Some Democratic Party leaders, however, are not displeased by the recent court decisions. They see those decisions changing district lines so that blacks, who vote about 90% for Democrats, will be added to newly Republican districts in the South and perhaps help Democrats to retake some of those districts. The situation is very much under discussion in Georgia, where, as you say, I was last weekend. In the past 6 years, Georgia's congressional delegation has changed from 9 Democrats and 1 Republican to 8 Republicans and 3 Democrats. African Americans are now concentrated in 3 Georgia districts, the only 3 which are still Democratic. Tony Center is an Atlanta attorney who ran as a Democrat against Newt Gingrich 4 years ago. He's running in the Democratic primary in Gingrich's district this year as well.
As Tom Murphy, our Speaker of the Georgia House, said, that the 1992 redistricting forced us to resegregate Georgia. Other people would call it the bleaching of our districts. Racial tension is still a problem. And I do believe that when Newt Gingrich and his cohorts eloquently talk about the welfare state and government handout, that underneath it all, they are playing on racial tension. Because when Newt Gingrich talks about welfare states and deadbeat dads, he's talking about black dads who aren't staying with their families. He's not talking about the next door neighbor who owns a $400,000 house who's not paying his child support for his children.
But Georgia and National Democratic Party officials don't hide their satisfaction with those court rulings about district lines. John Blackman is chair of the Georgia Democratic Party.
Here in Georgia, it is not a racial matter. It is a matter of Democrats competing and Democrats putting forth candidates who can defeat Republicans. If you take the newly constituted congressional districts and you look at the most recent vote, you will see that the majority of the new districts favor the Democratic nominee. We are absolutely confident that we can contribute to the retaking of the House of Representatives by the Democratic Party.
A possible victim of the court-ordered redistricting in Georgia is not pleased at what has happened to her district and to districts of other African-American Congress members in the South. Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney now must run in a new Georgia district, the 4th, which contains only 29% of her previous district. The African-American population of her newly drawn suburban Atlanta district is about half of what it was before, down from two-thirds of the population to about one-third. McKinney says blacks are now being considered as spare parts in the electoral process to be moved around to wherever the political power structure thinks they're most useful.
The situation as it unfolds in Georgia is very sad. I know that 31 years ago, black Americans and white Americans joined together and took a step. They took a step from Selma to Montgomery, and they had to cross the Edmund Pettus Bridge. And in so doing, the consciousness of America was awakened. As a result of those brave men and women, we got the Voting Rights Act. The state of Georgia, as well as other states now, are moving to invalidate the Voting Rights Act. And with nothing in its place, I fear for where America is headed. We know that the state of Georgia is taking the lead, and the state of Georgia is showing other states how to roll the hands on the clock back. You siphon off black votes, and you add them to white votes, and then you forestall the electoral aspirations of African Americans, and you perpetuate what the South has been known for all along. That, unfortunately, is what has motivated a lot of what we are seeing happening in these southern states, from Louisiana to Virginia to Georgia to Florida. We know that there is partisan motivation there.
Cynthia McKinney is one of 13 African Americans elected in recent years to new black majority districts in the South. The possibility that some or all of those House members may now lose their seats has many people in the South upset, including Leonard Tate, an Atlanta activist who chairs the political committee of the Atlanta Million Man March organization. But Tate makes clear that even with a redistricting controversy on his mind, he'll still be voting Democratic, at least for president.
The racism in the state of Georgia, particularly relative to politics and reapportionment, is the worst, most putrid, stupidest, backward human inhuman endeavors or activities. As witnessed by the Cynthia McKinney campaign and the way the Democratic Party and the Democratic pseudo-liberals within the DeKalb County Party and the rest of the state party are treating her, her campaign, and the whole issue of reapportionment in the state legislature. But that's racism. And the other thing is that racism has become such a cult in America and such a super cult in the state of Georgia. We're back to the latter Tom Watson days, the latter Reconstructed days, and even the legal community. You know, there was an old saying in the legal community, the Supreme Court reads the election returns. Well, the state court in Georgia, the Superior Court in Fulton County, and the appeals courts in the state of Georgia obviously not only reads the election returns, but they have their finger on the pulse of the mood of Georgia, and they make judicial policy and decisions according to the mood of the racism in this state.
And what's it going to take to change that?
One thing, it's going to take a lot of activism by blacks who have not been used to being activists. I'm not talking about your mainstream bourgeois activists who can keep up with when the Democratic Party has meetings and participate on a token basis in the Democratic Party of Georgia or the Young Democrats. I'm talking about grassroots people. We're going to have to be more aware. We're going to have to be more radical, more militant, and raise other issues in which white folks are going to have sense enough to wake up.
And yet in the final analysis, you see it necessary for people to vote for Bill Clinton. Hold your nose and vote for Bill, is that basically it?
Absolutely. Hold your nose and vote for Bill, because it's almost twiddly-dee and twiddly-dum between Clinton and Dole. However, there are some marginal issues that if the so-called pseudo-Democrats abandon that, the Republicans can come in and finish the job and put a coup de grace on our community such that we may not be able to recover from it. That's the state, that's the sad state of politics in America today.
Leonard Tate. The Georgia primary will be held on July 9th. Cynthia McKinney has two locally well-known opponents in her new district, Comer Yates and Ron Slotin, both of whom say they're not running against her, but because they believe they can better represent the district. Amy?
Very interesting report, Larry. And I dare say the Olympics will get a little more attention than that primary in Georgia.
Well, you know, it's going to be a runoff if neither one of those three or none of those three gets a majority July 9th. The runoff is right in the middle of the Olympics. It's a crazy situation.
Well, I guess then it's appropriate to call it a runoff. In just a minute, who has the right to test our genes? You're listening to Democracy Now. Stay with us. You're listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. This week, two U.S. Marines were court-martialed for refusing to allow the military to take blood and tissue samples from them for DNA identification. Well, the Pentagon claims the DNA would only be used to help identify service members killed in combat. The Marines were worried that their genetic information could be used against them in the future, perhaps by insurance companies, which have been known to deny health coverage to people who carry certain genes that are associated with diseases. The issue of DNA testing has raised the specter of genetic discrimination and poses serious questions about how science and technology can come into conflict with our privacy and democracy. It has also spawned a number of laws around the country around genetic discrimination. Joining us to talk about this issue are two people. Wendy McGoodwin is Executive Director of the Council for Responsible Genetics, which is a national nonprofit bioethics organization that's been providing technical assistance to the two Marines for the past year. And also Paul Billings, Associate Professor of Medicine at Stanford University and author of the book DNA on Trial, Genetic Identification and Criminal Justice. Billings was an expert witness in the trial. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Why don't we begin with Wendy McGoodwin? Wendy, can you tell us, before we go on to state legislation and also legislation that's been introduced into Congress, tell us about this trial that just finished up in the last 2 days of these two Marines. Why did they refuse to give their DNA to the military?
Well, Amy, I think that initially they just had some big unanswered questions about what the DNA would be used for. When they were ordered to give up those samples 14 months ago, they received very little information from their commanding officers about the purposes of this program.
How does it work, actually? They go for a physical and they say, give us some cheek?
Very clever. The military collects two DNA samples from every member of the armed services. They collect a sample of blood, usually from the tip of a finger, and also a scraping of cheek cells. One of those samples is stored with the medical record, and the other is shipped off to Gaithersburg, Maryland, where they are preserved in a massive DNA library. The two soldiers were about to be deployed, and they were ordered to report to their medical clinic with their unit in order to give up those DNA samples. Up until that morning, they had never heard of the existence of this DNA data bank. So it was really sort of sprung on them it was quite a surprise. After their initial refusal, they started investigating the program and looking also at the potential dangers around DNA collection and the use of genetic information outside of the medical setting, and they the more they learned about the dangers of genetic discrimination, I think the more this confirmed their initial impulse to resist the DNA sampling.
And so they were court-martialed this week. What happened exactly?
Well, their court-martial trial began last Monday, concluded last Tuesday. They were charged with failing to obey a direct order when they refused to give up that DNA sample. They faced a potential jail term of 6 months, loss of rank and pay, and bad conduct discharges, potentially a fairly serious scenario. The military judge found these two young men guilty of disobeying orders, but let them off with a slap on the wrist. They receive a very light punishment. They've been restricted to base for 7 days. They've essentially been grounded, and they have a written reprimand in their file. But considering the serious punishment which has been avoided, we are considering this a victory in this case. The lightness of the sentence, I think, is an indication that the military judge recognized the legitimacy and the seriousness of the concerns upon which their refusal was based.
Now, Wendy, you held a news conference here in Washington, D.C. last week. And as a result of that news conference, some people around the country heard what you had to say. And it sounds like another man, this time a sergeant, is being court-martialed for exactly the same thing.
That's right, Amy. One of the difficult things about for these soldiers is that it's very difficult for them to find out whether other court-martial cases are pending on the same subject matter. So, for instance, the two Marines were not able to get any information about other cases. When this started being covered in the national media, other soldiers around the country started learning about this, and we did get a call the day after the press conference from a sergeant, a 14-year veteran in the Air Force, who told us that he was also being court-martialed for the same reason. Up until that day, he had thought that he was alone in the world, that his case was a unique one. His trial is scheduled for later this month.
We're talking to Wendy Goodwin, Executive Director of the Council for Responsible Genetics. We're also joined by Paul Billings, Associate Professor of Medicine at Stanford, who's quite involved with these cases and also legislation around the country that's being introduced in response to cases like these. Paul Billings, have you been involved with this trial? How exactly have you been involved with it?
Well, I was an advisor to the defense team and helped them prepare the brief. And then on Monday, I testified two aspects of genetic discrimination, which were allowed as evidence in the trial.
What were these aspects of genetic discrimination?
Well, I pointed out to the court that repositories of genetic material like that being developed by the DOD can be used by other parties for a variety of purposes, including criminal investigations, but more importantly, to make assessments of people's genes and decide whether they should be available for health insurance or other kinds of insurance contracts, for employment, for adoption, and for other purposes. And
Paul Billings, you've been involved with writing legislation around the country. In fact, in California, you've helped write some of the legislation. Can you tell us what you're targeting, how you're writing this?
Well, initially, in most cases, in the states that I've been involved in legislation, we've tried to write broad-based legislation which would really prohibit on all fronts genetic discrimination. Unfortunately, because we often face very powerful lobbies who are in opposition to this kind of legislation, the laws usually become much more narrowly refined so that they often just deal with health insurance and generally prohibit the use by insurers of genetic information to either raise the rates or actually not offer contracts to individuals who are asymptomatic and have genetic predispositions.
Who are the lobbyists? Are they the insurance companies, the ones who are lobbying against this kind of legislation?
A very, very powerful lobby. Employers, to some extent, have also, particularly small employers, have been particularly concerned about this. I want to point out that there is a federal preemption in this field to a great extent. In most states, a large proportion of the people who have insurance, health insurance, usually have it from an employment setting, and employers who are self-insured, who essentially do their own insurance work, are covered by federal law, not state law, so many of these state laws don't apply to them.
Mm-hmm. Wendy McGoodwin of the Council for Responsible Genetics, how many states have anti-genetic discrimination laws?
11 states have enacted laws that prohibit certain kinds of genetic discrimination. Some of those states forbid genetic discrimination in health insurance. Others forbid genetic discrimination in employment.
Wendy, if you could just speak up a little. We've just moved into our new studios, and we're having a little trouble with our phone lines. Can you name these 11 states?
Certainly. The states that prohibit genetic discrimination in health insurance include California, Colorado, Georgia, Maryland, Minnesota, New Hampshire, Ohio, Oregon, and Wisconsin. There are a few additional states which prohibit genetic discrimination in employment. Those are Iowa, New Hampshire again, Rhode Island, and Wisconsin again.
Now, what does it mean to have these kind of laws in a state? If someone is asked by their employer to take a genetic test, what can they do?
Well, the laws vary considerably. Some are, we would consider to be effective prohibitions against genetic discrimination. Others are only marginally effective. In most cases, they do two things. They set up standards for genetic privacy. They limit who can request information about a person's genes. They limit redisclosure of genetic information. The second thing that they do is they address the discrimination aspect. They restrict the use of genetic information in business decisions, whether for decisions about employment prospects or insurance coverage.
What about the national legislation, Dr. Billings, in Congress now? We're talking about four different senators and Congress members who've introduced this. Who are they, and how are these similar, and how do they differ from the state legislation?
Well, they're Senator, the two main pieces of legislation on the Senate side have been introduced by Senator Hatfield and Senator Feinstein. And both of these pieces of legislation are similarly been introduced on the House side by Representative Joe Kennedy and Representative Slaughter. Both of these pieces of legislation would prohibit genetic discrimination in health insurance matters. They're otherwise quite similar pieces of legislation. The language of the bills, the definition of terms and so forth are quite similar. The Hatfield legislation is maybe a tad more comprehensive than the Feinstein piece, but both would be a substantial advancement since there is no federal legislation at all on this matter.
And what do they say?
Well, they essentially prohibit the use of genetic information in health insurance underwriting and for the rating of individuals in such matters.
So do you expect a tremendous lobby to come down on them as they try to push this through the Senate and also the House?
Well, I believe the insurance industry will oppose this legislation. I also think that this is an election year, and this kind of legislation may find itself bogged down in election year positioning. There is also the Kennedy-Kassenbaum Insurance Reform Act, which is about pre-existing conditions and the allowing of pre-existing conditions to remain insured if people change employment or change insurance carriers. This has included at times, sometimes in its legislative history, has included genetic predisposition and sometimes has not included genetic predisposition. I hope that it will include this kind of information as part of its legislative language as well.
Let me ask you something. I'm wondering if in these kind of cases we see categories of right and left breaking down, because on the one hand you have these issues of privacy. On the other hand, you take issues like legislation around HIV and people who have AIDS. You might have more conservatives, the right-wingers, saying we have to know there should be mandatory testing. But on the other hand, we're talking about government invasion of people's lives or industry invasion of them, you know, the insurance industry finding out what is inside our actual genetic blueprint. How does it break down politically when you introduce this kind of legislation?
Well, that's been very interesting. I think you highlight a very interesting point, which is that sort of traditional liberty issues are difficult to size up by party on this. In general, the issue most recently has been that the Republican or the right has opposed this legislation, that it's unnecessary or it's a constraint on business when business can take care of this without further laws, and that it's sort of unnecessary legislation. So in general, these laws have been carried by Democrats or the left as a, you know, an extension of government protection of individual rights. This hasn't been uniformly the case. For instance, in Minnesota, the legislation was carried by a Republican, and in other states as well, there has been substantial Republican help with this kind of with these kinds of laws.
Well, that has certainly been the case in New Hampshire, which last year passed a broad genetic discrimination bill. New Hampshire, certainly one of the most conservative states in the nation, with a, I believe, an 80% Republican majority in their state legislature. But they passed one of the very strongest genetic discrimination laws. So we really, I think it's been a somewhat variable experience state by state in terms of bipartisan support. In some cases, though, if we're talking about a Republican majority, in many cases those Republicans care about privacy. That they understand that they don't want employers or insurance companies prying into their genes, into their genetic makeup, which they consider rightly to be a very personal matter.
Wendy McGoodwin, let me ask you something. We see now that the military is saying we need this information to identify war remains, and we're not going to use it for anything else.
Mm-hmm.
But several years ago, it seems that they said the same thing when it came to mandatory HIV testing. Can you tell us about the progression of what happened?
Yes. The military currently says that they want this DNA for the identification of war remains. That seems to be a fairly worthwhile goal. And our concern, of course, is that they might at a later date change the policy and start using the DNA for harmful purposes. That fear is based on a historical reality, and you've accurately raised the question about the HIV screening program in the military. Several years ago, the military instituted a mandatory HIV screening program.
Wendy, we just have 20 seconds.
They wanted to do that to keep the blood supply safe, a fairly laudable goal. However, 3 months ago, they changed that policy and started discharging all HIV-positive personnel. I think there's every danger that we might see a similar reversal of policy with the DNA databank.
Well, Wendy McGoodwin and Paul Billings want to thank you very much. Again, Wendy McGoodwin, Executive Director of the Council for Responsible Genetics, based in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Dr. Billings, Associate Professor of Medicine at Stanford. And Wendy McGoodwin's number at the Council for Responsible Genetics is, Wendy? 617, I'll give it then, 868-0870. That's 617-868-0870. Democracy Now! Is produced by Julie Drizin with help from Pat Greenfield. Our engineer is Kenneth Mason. Tune in tomorrow when we take a look at the first anniversary of the Oklahoma City bombing and the legislation just passed by the Senate, the so-called anti-terrorism bill. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!